The power of radio, then.
All the humanity and all the fantasy.
I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air.
Good night, and good luck.
And now. Today is World Radio Day. For the past 7 years, UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, has celebrated the power and reach of radio on February 13th. Radio reaches the widest audience in the world. In the U.S. alone, more than 90% of people listen at least once a week. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are going to discuss the power of radio, its history, and its future. Do you have a memory of hearing something important on the radio? Do you stream your radio now or listen to podcasts? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There is a very good chance you are hearing my voice right now through your radio. Maybe you're in your car, or maybe you're in your kitchen. Radio is everywhere. And today is World Radio Day. So today we're going to look back at radio's past, discuss today's many options for listening to your favorite programs, and peek into the future of listening via smart devices such as smart speakers. Joining me in the studio, Michael Socolo. He is an associate professor at the University of Maine. He is a media historian and a former broadcast journalist. His book is, most recent book, 6 Minutes in Berlin, Broadcast Spectacle and Rowing Gold at the Nazi Olympics. And on the line with us from the studios of WDET in Detroit, Paul Jacobs. He is vice president and general manager of Jacobs Media Strategies. Jacobs Media Strategies provides research and consulting expertise to radio broadcasters, television networks, digital media, and podcasters. As always, we want to hear from you. We would love for you to share some of your favorite radio memories or talk about how you use radio today, especially if it's changing. Do you listen to podcasts? Use a smart speaker? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Mike, I'll start with you. We have a lot of media choices these days, not just newspapers, magazines, books, TV, and radio, but also the web and everything that comes with it, smartphones, smart speakers, podcasts, etc. And there are still only 24 hours in a day. So despite all that, terrestrial radio, which is so old-fashioned, endures, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I mean, we're almost at a century, right? In 1920, it'll be 100 years since KDKA in Pittsburgh really started broadcasting as we know it. And yet the American public listens. Over 90% of people listen to radio every day, which is a higher penetration rate than even the web. It's just amazing that a medium that's 100 years old like that, that's electric, ephemeral, that just goes out in the air and disappears, could still be so embedded in our lives.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it is that idea that it is electric. It is the idea that we're having a conversation right now, and hundreds of thousands, if not a million people, are listening to us. It's almost like, you know, a live telephone call that people are participating in, a conversation. It's that sense of connection that radio has that I don't think TV or the web really have.
A sense of connection that even though there may be many, many people listening, it's still very intimate. You're probably all by yourself when you're listening.
Right. And it's very personal. And you have the theater of the mind and you build radio. It's funny. Marshall McLuhan, the media theorist, said that radio works because it places psyche and society in a single echo chamber. In other words, it takes us as individuals and it makes us have a sense of being part of this larger community. And the live aspect really matters. Radio is almost always live. I mean, except for podcasts and the way radio is changing now. But radio really gets its strength from that live connection, like a call-in show like this.
Mm. Paul, welcome to Maine Calling. Let's talk about some of those newfangled ways to listen to audio content. If I stream a radio show, let's say someone's listening to a podcast of Maine Calling over his or her smartphone, are they listening to radio then, or is it something different?
What a great question. technically, yes, but not necessarily. The fact is that Maine Public Radio is probably no longer purely in the radio business. The fact is, you're in the audio business. And does it really matter if you're reaching audience out of a transmitter and tower through Alexa or through a smartphone? So the only thing that really has changed is the distribution and the way we account for it. So it's no longer becoming ratings-based to measure your impact on people who listen to you, but it really is the aggregated way in which you can touch people. And people are changing. The toothpaste is out of the tube, so now it's just up to us broadcasters to figure out how to most effectively and efficiently distribute our content.
Paul, Mike mentioned that more than 90% of Americans still listen to terrestrial radio, and that number has pretty much stayed steady for almost the last decade. Do you think as more and more people are buying these smart speakers and using their smartphones that number will go down, or do you think people are adding to?
I think both. But the fact is that when you look at all traditional media, newspaper, television, radio, all have been impacted by digital distribution. The beauty of radio is that, as Mike said, it has been impacted much, much less. So, but the shift is happening. And, you know, what Mike shared with you is the accurate reach of radio. But when you start looking underneath the data and you start looking at time spent listening, it actually is starting to tick down. And when you look at it generationally and you look at millennials, that number has really started to fall. And it isn't that they're not listening to your content. It's just the amount of time spent listening through the radio is shifting over to things like mobile apps.
I actually do worry a little bit about the future. Mike, I've got two teenagers, and when they're on their devices, they're not listening. They're either reading or watching.
Well, there's sort of two aspects here. There's the business aspect of radio. There's the question of whether your teenagers could be commodified with podcasts, for instance. And if you look at something like Slate's podcast network called Panoply, it's doing very, very well. It's almost at 50% of their revenue. But then there's the other question about this wide variety of choices and the sort of hyper-competitive world of podcasting. There's so many out there that your teenagers may be listening to ones that have a smaller reach. They may be great, they may be interesting, but it's sort of that democratization of the media and what that will do to it. But your teenagers will be driving cars, and cars, while they can plug in their devices and listen to their podcasts and choose that way, I think as long as we're driving and as long as we're cooking in the kitchen and as long as we have that option, I think listening to the live broadcast will always be somewhat popular.
Paul, is there any such thing as silence in today's world?
No. No, I don't think so. And, you know, what you're really describing is something that we're seeing everywhere. We go to the Consumer Electronics Show every year, and it's, you know, while you don't see radios there, it is an audio renaissance time, you know, with things like the podcast distribution networks and streaming explosion and radio holding on. Americans are consuming a ton of audio. And so that's why this isn't the worst of times for the industry. And Mike is also correct in terms of in-car listening. That is the last bastion of real dominance that radio has. It is primary to the industry. I live in Detroit, so I actually do a lot of work with the auto industry, and we're working with the industry to make sure that radio continues to have a great presence in the car. But at the same time, listening at home has declined, and you know, all you need to do is walk into a Best Buy and try to buy a radio. But along comes Amazon with Alexa, and now we're seeing the beginnings of a rebound within home radio listening.
Well, so we're going to have some fun and listen back to some radio history. And our first clip is part of a very famous program. This is Orson Welles' 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast, in which the Mercury Theater on the air enacted a Martian invasion of Earth.
A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Good Lord, they're turning into flame. The whole field's caught on fire. The woods, the barns, the gas tanks of automobiles, it's spreading everywhere. It's coming this way, about 20 yards to my right.
Well, Mike, what I had always heard is that there has been mass hysteria because people believe that there was a Martian invasion. But you wrote an article about this and say that's a myth, right?
I've actually written several articles. My co-author is Jefferson Pooley on these articles, and we've both done research into the history of mass communication. So I've done scholarly research, and I've written for Slate. And yes, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, but let me just prep before I mention there's no panic. There was a very, very small panic, and this has since been ratified by other scholars like A. Brad Schwartz and Broadcast Hysteria and stuff. It's a great program. It's a wonderful program. In your mind, you listen to it. It's just brilliantly acted, incredibly well written. I have nothing against the show War of the Worlds, but this idea that millions of Americans panicked, it simply didn't happen.
Okay. Paul, one thing this shows is how radio drama was such a big part of radio in the past. Does this new media landscape open up more opportunities for a return of more drama in radio?
It's happening. And public radio stations and NPR, people like at WNYC have really recreated the art form in the era of podcasts. And so, you know, we're hearing things like Serial and Invisibilia and a whole new wave of creativity that is coming in. And yeah, there is room for this. And I think you're going to hear more and more.
All right. Well, so we're going to go to one more clip. This is from the 1951 World Series. Okay, Mike, what's the story behind this clip?
Well, actually, that clip, just to clarify something, that was for the National League pennant. That was between the Dodgers and the Giants.
Sorry.
To see who was going to play the Yankees in the World Series. And it was 4-2 in the bottom of the ninth, and Thompson hits the home run with two guys on base, and they win 5-4. But the story of how that very famous audio, it might be one of the most famous audio clips of sportscasting ever recorded, got saved is incredible. That did not come from the radio station WHN, which broadcast the game. A teenager in Brooklyn had gotten a recording device as a gift, and he asked his mother. He was at school that afternoon. It was a day game. And he asked his mother to record the end of the game because he could only get up to 15 minutes on it. And so she was listening to the game, and as it got into the ninth inning, she pressed record, and he recorded it. And it's one of the most iconic and famous sportscasts, and it was saved for us just by somebody in their living room in Brooklyn, New York. And that's sort of, I'm part of this radio preservation task force of the Library of Congress, and we're trying to get historical audio. We're trying to preserve it and archive it the way we think about films and the way we think about newspapers. And that's just a story, an incredible story of how this really memorable sportscast was saved.
So is this partially a plea to anybody out there who might have a recording of their radio?
Absolutely. Please contact me at the University of Maine. If you are out there in Maine and you have any kind of archival broadcast that's taped or recorded, and I'd be very interested in hearing from you.
Paul, what is the role of sports in this new radio landscape?
As big as ever. We're seeing, on the commercial radio side, rights fees continuing to climb. You know, in New England, you have WEEI in Boston with the Red Sox, just this dominant behemoth galvanizing people throughout New England to hear their beloved Red Sox. So it is huge. And, the trends are not abating. It is something you're not going to podcast or time shift. You're going to listen to it live. And, while we're not communally gathering around the radio in the living room the way we used to, sports remains, just like anything live, in the moment. I think, just one of those enduring parts of the radio business.
I want to talk about Maine. And I want to ask you, Mike, I know that Maine has an important place in radio history. I understand it was somebody at WCSH in Portland who spurred the founding of the RTNDA. People outside of the business might not know what that is. It's the Radio and Television News Directors Association, which is really the prominent force in radio and television news, founded by somebody here in Portland, Maine, but there are other great examples of how Maine was a leader back in the day.
Maine was a very important national center of radio in the 1920s and 30s. So WCSH, for instance, here in Portland, the radio station was one of the original NBC affiliates. And WLBZ in Bangor was one of the original CBS affiliates in 1926 and in 1927. This is when the networks had 10 stations. So they really were very important. And at one point in 1930, the New York Times wrote an article called Life Down East Wins Radio Applause. And it was about how three different radio shows set in Maine were in the top five in the national broadcast. There was Uncle Abe and David, which was set in Skowhegan. There was Seth Parker, which was a show about a local store in Jonesport, Maine. And there was Rudy Valley's Fleischman East Hour, which was actually the number one show on radio. And everybody was talking about Maine from about 1929 to 1931.
That's so neat. And before we go to a break, I want to ask you, Paul, about smart speakers. Apparently, they were the hot hit of this holiday season. How many people are using smart speakers to make a grocery list, and how many people are using them to listen to radio in their homes?
Well, out of nowhere, ownership, the research we've done and seen shows that about 18% of American homes already have a smart speaker, which is an Amazon Alexa, a Google Home, and as of 2 weeks ago, the Apple HomePod. And so the data are not granular enough for us to really understand if it's grocery lists or asking to hear Maine Public Radio, but usage is climbing. We actually have a study in the field right now, and one of the things that we're seeing is the breadth of use. That's the hundreds and hundreds of ways in which people are using these now as a tool and as entertainment in their homes.
Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. And Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud to support the independent journalism and new voices of Maine Public News.
Some Christian leaders are worried that their churches wouldn't survive a crackdown on immigration.
Mass deportation of current immigrants in America will do nothing less than cripple American Christianity for generations to come, and arguably, in a definitive manner.
I'm Ari Shapiro, Immigration and the Future of American Christianity, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Governor Paul LePage gives his last State of the State address this evening, and Maine Public News will be there. You can watch on Maine Public Television or listen here on Maine Public Radio starting at 7 o'clock this evening. You can also stream it live on the Maine Public Facebook page or at mainepublic.org, or you can watch it on demand later if you wish. Maine Public Radio will also rebroadcast the address and legislative reaction at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. For those of you who watch the PBS NewsHour, that will be seen an hour earlier this evening at 6 o'clock, and as always at 10 on the World Channel and then 11 o'clock on our main channel.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, radios, past, present, and future. In the studio with me, Michael Socolow, associate professor at the University of Maine. He is a media historian and former broadcast journalist. In 2016, he published the book 6 Minutes in Berlin, Broadcast Spectacle and Rowing Gold at the Nazi Olympics. On the line with us, Paul Jacobs. He's vice president and general manager of Jacobs Media Strategies. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Mike, before we went to a break, we were talking about WCSH. People may not know the call letters stand for Congress Square Hotel, because the radio studios were in the top floor of the Congress Square Hotel right in downtown Portland. On the line with us from Paris, France, is Tim Francis. He is an associate program specialist for media development and society with UNESCO. Tim, thanks for calling in today.
Thanks for having me.
Why is UNESCO, why is United Nations so interested in promoting radio?
Well, basically, this was the creation of World Radio Day, which is celebrated today across the world. I think it's just really a day to celebrate the importance of radio. I think all of your listeners will agree that it's something that plays a really hugely important role in people's lives. It's sort of, it's entertainment, it's news, it's music, it's all of these things. And it was really created as a way to not just celebrate radio, but to discuss some of the important issues that face the radio, face radio around the world. Obviously, it's something that is going through a lot of changes, and so it's really a chance to take a look at some of these issues and to promote sort of cooperation and dialogue around them.
The theme of this year's World Radio Day is radio and sports. Why sports, and what are your favorite radio sports memories?
Well, for me, I think, I'm from New Zealand, but I've lived in different countries around the world working with the UN, and it's definitely, I appreciate the fact that I can stay in touch with what's happening in my home country. I guess the specific moments won't be as well understood by your listeners. New Zealand winning the Rugby World Cup in 2011, for example, it was something I had to experience through radio. There was a big time difference, and I think this is really why we wanted to look at sports as a thing. We've covered things like gender equality in radio. We've covered, you know, how important radio is in humanitarian disaster situations. But we wanted to look at sports because it's something that, you know, billions of people around the world, are passionate about. And most of those people experience sports through the media and often through radio. And each time we really develop, you know, very specific angles that we want to look at. And I think that one of the big ones this year is gender equality. We want to really look at the way that women's sports are covered, for example, in the media. We did a big study in 2015, and roughly, I think, just over 100 countries, and found that only 4% of sports stories in the media focus mostly on women. Only 7% of sports people appearing in the media are women. Mm. A lot of work to be done in terms of this, and then even just the types of coverage. I mean, you have, even when women are covered, we've seen examples already from the Winter Olympics where you have sort of, I guess, in the form of objectification of women athletes, focusing on their appearance, focusing on their family lives, this kind of thing. And the other part of the day is really just to look at maybe having a coverage of a wider range of sports, you know, traditional sports, what you'd call sort of slightly marginalized sports that don't attract as much coverage, and these kind of things. So it's really a call for more diversity in sports coverage.
And quickly, Tim, can you give us a sense of how radio is doing compared to TV and the internet in other parts of the world? Is radio's use rising or declining?
I obviously, we wouldn't say it's rising. It depends really what you consider to be radio. It's a part of a wider question on that issue. There's big transformations happening all across the media sector. We're seeing this trend towards, you know, online content and sort of audio, video, and written content. So it really does depend. But then you also have other regions where radio is extremely important. You have communities where radio is really the only source of information for these kind of local communities. And especially in developing regions. So while we want to look at the future and make sure radio is prepared and can adapt to the future of online content, which I think it is, we also don't want to forget that in many places people really rely on radio as their only connection point to the world.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for joining us today from Paris, France. Tim Francis, Associate Program Specialist for Media Development and Society with UNESCO. We're going to go to Elaine, who's calling from Surrey. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having this program on a subject that a lot of people think is kind of irrelevant now. I am a volunteer DJ at a local community radio station, and I wanted to bring up the subject of community radio, about which I read a recent article in the New York Times. It was just in January, and they had an article about a surge in new community radio stations, which function as like neighborhood bulletin boards and voices of the counterculture or social justice. For me, I became drawn to volunteer because I enjoy bonding with other people over music and find listening to Spotify to be a very cold thing, a cold way to discover music. And I'd rather listen to someone play music that they're passionate about. And so that's how I ended up volunteering. So I just wanted to bring up the subject of community radio and see what your guests have to say about that. Thank you.
Sure, Elaine. Thanks. Michael, community radio alive and well.
Yeah. Low-powered FM, LPFM is growing. And up here in Maine, we have WERU, which is one of the great community radio stations.
In Blue Hill and WMPG in Portland. A tweet from Marfine: I'm a millennial and commute to and from Portland and Augusta. Don't know what I'd do without Maine Public and NPR. My question: how have Spotify and music subscription streaming services disrupted the music and radio industry? Paul, I'm giving you that one.
Well, thank you. A nice, easy softball. Yes, I mean, there's choice, there's options, and listeners are gravitating. But I actually want to tie that to the last point regarding low-power FMs. We, and actually millennials, we did a study called the Millennial Research Project for Public Radio last year. And one of the things we found that is most appealing to millennials about radio is its ability to cover local and local issues, like your last caller mentioned. You know, if you think about it, music is a bit of a commodity now with Spotify. National and international news you can get anywhere, but it is that local piece that is so precious to radio, is something that's so important to your communities. But if radio wants to continue to appeal to millennials, it is hyper-focusing on what is happening in the community, community issues, entertainment, and things like that. So I think it's all kind of tied together.
We'll go to Steve in Brewer. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. There used to be a AM station called, I think it was Stephen King's old station, but they had Mighty John, who had this radio station, Rock and Roll, and I think it was late 70s, early 80s, and then they had a Bounty Bandstand. It was so popular. MTV even came to Bangor because his show was so popular, and it was a lot of fun. And he's a record, vinyl record expert. He's probably about 80, 90 years old. But and then there was an AM station was very popular, Machias, and it was called Sandy Sales. I mean, I love the AM. I still listen, actually, to that old country station that's up in Bangor called 1400. So, and I listen to a lot of radio on TuneIn. I'm listening now to your station on TuneIn, and I can listen to virtually anywhere, and even listen to Winston Churchill's speeches. And
yeah.
Christmas time, you can listen to the old World War II, Vietnam, Bob Hope shows, because they broadcast those over, what was it called? Armed Services Radio, I think it was.
Yeah, well, so, Steve, thank you for your reminiscences. And I remember getting my first AM radio, and at night you could get stations from far away. I mean, there's still something really special about AM.
And Stephen King is still supporting those AM stations up at Bangor. And I agree. One of the great things about AM radio is the distance of the signal, because on a clear night up here in Maine, you can pick up Wheeling, West Virginia, or North Carolina, or sometimes even as far as Florida. Unfortunately, around the world, the AM radio spectrum is being auctioned off, and it's being closed off. And even FM now is starting, much to my surprise. I think Norway is the country that just got rid of their FM band. FM is starting to be sold off in spectrum, and Paul can probably speak a little bit about that. But if that ever comes to America, that's going to be a massive change, I think.
Yes, it is a concern, and Norway did sell off the FM spectrum, and everything is digital there. But part of the difference, one of the fascinating things about American broadcast, whether it's public radio or commercial radio, is that there's literally thousands and thousands of entities, and getting them to agree to do anything is impossible. So what happened in Norway is all the broadcasters agreed and worked with the government to get it done. Here in the States, I just don't see that. So, that's the good news. But there is pressure in automobiles. There are some BMWs that have dropped AM, and other car manufacturers talk about AM creating interference with the new telematics in the vehicle. And so one of the long-term concerns that we're working with the auto industry on is figuring out how to technically keep AM radio in cars as they become more electrified.
Rick on Facebook writes, "Unfortunately, radio in the U.S. has become less a matter of serving communities and making money. Big corporations have gobbled up stations that actually used to have local voices behind the microphone." Michael, there's been a lot of consolidation, but is that really true? There's still a lot of local DJs, at least here in the Portland area, and pretty certain in Bangor as well.
Well, I was about to say, we're actually quite lucky. We still have a vibrant and fertile local media markets, but the truth is, around much of America, you have this consolidation, and it is frankly obvious when you tune around on the dial and you hear the same newscaster on six or seven different stations. You know, for instance, that's one way. And then you look at the amount of debt these big companies have taken on, and the problems that, for instance, iHeartRadio is facing right now. It is a problem nationally, I would say, but we're really lucky here in Maine.
Interesting. Thanks, Rick, for that question. We'll go to Paul calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a story and then a question. My grandfather, A.E. Barnard, was the head of AAA here and read serialized stories to children through the 40s and 50s, always closing with "always alert, never hurt." People who are in their 80s would remember that well. Once the children were grown, they often told me that he had a great influence on them getting into reading. And I'm wondering if you still see radio having that sort of personal effect.
Can I just really quickly throw something in here, which is that I've read your grandfather's book. It was published, and it's at the Library of Congress, right? They published the actual broadcast for WCSH, right? Around 37.
Thank you for letting me know.
I'll tell you what, contact me at the University of Maine. I'll help you find that book. But that's great.
Absolutely.
That's great. And the second part of your question, I'm sorry?
Do you see radio still having that kind of personal effect?
I do. I'm curious, Paul, do you see that nationally?
You know, it's getting harder with young people to get them interested in radio because there's so many other, in some way of thinking, sexier options. Yet, I'm on a foundation board where we raise money for scholarships for young broadcasters, for college education, things like that. And I have to tell you, with all the work we're doing in the schools, radio continues to have appeal. It's not as deep as it was, you know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s. Radio, if you think about it, was really all we had, and FM was starting to blow up, so it became ours. So it was much more relatable then. But the fact is that, you know, look, everything in our culture is not the way it was, and there are more options, more choices, and everything else. For people to conclude that radio has seen better days and is over the hill, though, is kind of like millions and millions of people went crazy and jumped off of bridges during War of the Worlds.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. We're going to go to Steve calling from New Brunswick. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Maybe my question doesn't have much to do with this program, but what I was thinking was you indicated that radio waves have been around for 100 years. And radio travels at the speed of light. So does that mean that these radio waves are beaming out into space and could come in contact with distant stars?
Interesting question.
And are you familiar with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence?
I've heard of it, yes.
Yep, that's what that is. They are studying the radio waves that have gone out for 100 years. I think the movie Contact actually begins with an alien discovering, or we discover that an alien has seen the broadcast of the 1936 Olympics because it had been traveling for so long. The radio waves through space question is one that has fired sort of the imagination of science fiction. You know, we could not have gone to the moon if we didn't discover FM radio. This is what people always forget. AM radio is constricted by the atmosphere. We needed a form of radio that would be able to pierce the atmosphere. And literally, there were tests where FM radio was bounced off the moon like a satellite. And we figured out that we could speak to the spaceship that allowed us to go into space. People forget that really incredible role that radio played in the space exploration.
That's a great bit of history, Mike. And when Steve was asking his question, what I was thinking is, if there's someone out there listening and they've been hearing our radio broadcast all these years, what do they think of us? Steve, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Ralph in Belgrade. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thank you. The little criticism of radio, during the Reagan administration, they deregulated the FCC. It enabled the likes of Rush Limbaugh, Hannity, and Beck to take over some of the airwaves without proper rebuttal. And it's very serious. It enabled a man called Trump to get into office that would not have got in.
Yeah, Ralph, thanks. I think you're making a good point. And Mike, he's talking about fair use, isn't he?
He is talking about fair use, but it's a little bit more complicated because there were people like Bob Grant on WABC, and Paul would probably know this better than me, but there were people, Joe Pine in Southern California, there were radio hosts that were allowed to be sort of proto-Rush Limbaughs in the 60s and 70s. So the expansion of right-wing radio has a lot to do with satellite distribution and other things, I think.
Paul?
And efficiency. Look, the fairness doctrine going away, you know, definitely changed the balance of broadcasting. But, you know, regardless of your political orientation, broadcasters like Limbaugh became popular, but that didn't preclude people on the other side of the political spectrum to achieve their own degree of popularity. So, you know, I think you have to look at, you know, did Limbaugh succeed because of the fairness doctrine or because, you know, he was able to tap into some people? And, you know, so it's hard to look at that issue without that kind of context. Fact is, when the fairness doctrine was here, there's no question that all broadcasting, radio and TV, had a much greater sense of balance that today, honestly, only public radio provides.
But one thing I want to point out, Paul, and I'm curious what you think of this, is that for a long time, a lot of people listen to radio they don't necessarily agree with or like. So, for instance, people were surprised at how many women listened to Shock Jocks and Howard Stern. And Rush Limbaugh reliably had about, I believe this is right, you would know, about a third of his audience is liberal, and about 20% of public broadcasting's audience is very conservative.
Mike, you are dead on. And, you know, and the Shock Jock thing with Stern and women is also true. Interestingly, about 20 years ago, we did some research on behalf of NPR where we identified Rush Limbaugh listeners and we had them listen to public radio. They had never listened to public radio before. And we did focus groups and brought them in and said, what do you think? And they were shocked how much they liked it.
That's a great story. We do have to take another break, but before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to get reaction and analysis to the governor's final State of the State address, which is tonight, broadcast live at 7. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Senior Guide, an online resource of services and information for Maine seniors and their families. More at MaineSeniorGuide.com. And Nancy Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences.
On the next Speaking in Maine, we visit the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations.
What's the risk if you live on the coast of Maine? What's the risk that you get hit by a Category 2 hurricane over the next 100 years? Is that risk changing in time?
Kerry Emanuel is a professor of meteorology at MIT. He studies tropical climate, the power of hurricanes, and how climate change plays a role. You can hear the discussion on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
The top high school quiz teams from Boston, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island, and Maine will be competing later this spring to be the best in the region. High School Quiz Show Maine is now underway to find our state champion. You can watch the action and test yourself as well by watching Maine Public Television at 8 o'clock Thursday evenings. Teams from all around the state, from Bangor to Cape Elizabeth to Auburn, are competing to answer questions about Maine, science, current events, history, math, popular culture, and various other academic topics. Which school will come out on top here in Maine? And how will they do against other New England states? You can watch Thursday evenings at 8 o'clock and Sunday afternoons at 5:30 on Maine Public Television. Information about High School Quiz Show Maine, what's involved, how to form a team and register for next year, and to watch completed contests are at mainepublic.org. Just click on television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all about radio. Joining me today, Michael Socolow, associate professor at the University of Maine, who is a media historian and former broadcast journalist. On the line with us from the studios of WDET in Detroit, Paul Jacobs. He is vice president and general manager of Jacobs Media Strategies. Jacobs Media Strategies provides research and consulting expert to radio broadcasters, television networks, digital media, and podcasters. If you'd like to join our conversation, talk about radio with us, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to calls, though, Mike, I want to ask you about your book. The title, again, 6 Minutes in Berlin, Broadcast Spectacle and Rowing Gold at the Nazi Olympics. What are those 6 minutes?
The 6 minutes are the gold medal race in which a group of 8 students from the University of Washington won a gold medal, and millions of Americans heard them, and they won it in front of Hitler and the Nazi bigwigs and 75,000 screaming German fans. And I take that one moment and I sort of expand it out to talk about how the invention of global sports broadcasting occurs at the personal, the national, and even the global level, because so many people around the world had heard this broadcast. And it was really Germany in the 1930s as a propaganda tactic that invented the idea of exploiting the Olympic Games. And they were the ones who put together the first live global live broadcasts of the Olympic Games. So the 1936 Berlin Olympics were heard by 300 million people around the world. And it turned Jesse Owens into possibly the most famous athletic superstar of the 20th century. And it was really pioneered in that way. This idea of live global sports broadcasting was pioneered in radio in the 1930s in Germany.
And here we are in the middle of another Olympics with controversy, lots of controversies.
Well, there's lots of controversies, but it's interesting that World Radio Day is about sports and gender equity, because I was just thinking last night I was watching the Chloe Kim race with my boys. I have 2 boys, one age 14, one age 12, and my wife, and we were all there, and we were really enjoying it. And there was a perfect example of how women's athletics, when a large audience is exposed to it through broadcasting, when there is an effort made to produce some kind of gender equity in broadcasting, it works. Look at the 1999 World Cup and the women's soccer team. And radio can play a role in that, I think, as television is doing right now.
Mm. Paul, I want to ask you if there's anything that you've been doing research on recently that's really surprised you about radio and how people listen today?
Boy, I could go on for an hour. You know, it has not been any one thing that has just blown up. It is everything. I really think it is this diaspora of content access that audience is doing that it's like molasses, but it is streaming along really fast. And so the thing that concerns me amongst the data that we see is, are broadcasters responding quickly enough? Are they holding too tight to the transmitter and tower mentality, or are they making the investment and creating the content in a form that works for each of these platforms in order to truly take advantage of it? The bottom line is the audience is moving. The audience is looking for different ways to access your content. And so all broadcasters need to answer that question and make sure that they are. Otherwise, you know, per the caller regarding Spotify, the audience has so many more options today than they've ever had. And so, you know, everybody should make a big donation to Maine Public Radio so you can continue to invest in all of these platforms.
Isn't it challenging, though, whether it's public radio and public television or commercial radio and television, to find a way to do all that? I mean, budgets are tight at all sorts of radio and television stations to continue to provide the over-the-air service, but then also develop entire new departments to address the future.
It truly is. And, you know, not to disparage commercial radio, but public radio's quality standards are so high that, you know, it becomes a real challenge and a stretch on resources to do all of this. But to create skills for Alexa can cost a couple of $1,000s. To produce a really great mobile app can be between $5,000 and $15,000. You know, so at that point, you at least have the distribution box checked. When you start moving into things like podcasting, most local stations, like yours can't create a serial type thing, because I mean the amount of investment that went into that was high. But can you create podcasts? Can you go to your community and identify local podcasters? So I think we have to be somewhat creative, but you know, like most digital companies that aren't media, put it out there, fail, fix, improve, and continue to move forward.
Isn't one of the challenges, too, a rural and urban challenge, Mike? I mean, we're here in Maine where we are among the states with the worst rural high-speed internet connection. I mean, there are people who can't be downloading podcasts even if they want to. Lots of people.
Right. And one thing I should point out is that Maine Public and the radio network are extremely important here. If you find in states that have smaller populations spread over a very large geographic network, so Alaska, Hawaii, Maine, the public radio network is extremely important for weather and emergencies. And that's why here in Maine, there's a small budget line to make sure that that Maine Public covers 100% of the state where everybody is and can be reached in case of an emergency, because the commercial industry won't do that. And I'd like to point out one thing that's interesting. A lot of people who are probably listening associate Maine Public with National Public Radio, but they're different. National Public Radio is a big, mammoth, very wealthy organization with the Kroc money in Washington, D.C. that charges the stations here and around America for their programming. And so it's very important that when you think about Maine Public, and I'm a Maine Public member, I have to be transparent here, admit it, but I would really strongly support, I would encourage people to support Maine Public because it's very important.
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to read a post from Diane Atwood, my former coworker on Facebook. Hi, Diane. She writes, I'm a former television health reporter who now has a blog called Catching Health with Diane Atwood. About a year ago, I added a podcast, which I love doing. I'd like to connect with other podcasters in Maine. Are you aware of any kind of network or association? Mike, do you know of a network or association in Maine? And Paul, do you know of one nationally?
In Maine, I'm not really sure of one. That sounds like a great project, Diane. I'd be interested in helping.
And nationally, there are a ton. You know, there's Libsyn, there's Panoply, there's Midroll. We're working with a group of women in San Diego, believe it or not, that have bandied together and formed this collective of podcasts. So there's a lot out there, and I invite your ex-coworker to contact me. You've got my information, and I'll be more than happy to connect her with some of these groups.
Super. And our producer, Jonathan Smith, wants me to mention that we are thinking about doing a show on podcasting and podcasters. So if you have any thoughts on that, send us an email and we'll pay attention. Rick Lindquist on Facebook posted, Mighty John Marshall was on WGUI in Bangor. He was an Elvis expert. When Elvis died, I interviewed John for a TV story I did when I was working for Channel 7 WVII, and that's in Bangor. You're grinning, Mike. You know about this.
Well, I'm not really sure, but I know those stations in Bangor have legendary stories. And we have a former general manager of WLBZ, the Stephen King station, Barry Darling, up at the University of Maine, who's digitizing these incredible recordings from the 40s and 50s, a couple from the 30s. And we at the University of Maine have put some of the clips on a webpage at Fogler Library.
An email from Zach. I think FM radio is still the best option for listening. It's simple, reliable, and costs almost nothing to use. I gave up on TV several years ago and find that radio offers much better information and entertainment, including your show, thank you, and programs like LA Theater Works. Paul, you know, I hear this a lot. I've worked in television and radio, and there some people have a kind of either-or kind of attitude about it. I happen to love both.
What, in terms of working in one or the other?
Well, no, I think a lot of the audience, people sort of who listen to radio and love radio are sometimes a little, I don't know what the right word is for it. It feels strongly about radio.
You know, yes, I think if you love radio, you truly love radio, but that doesn't mean you're not watching television or using Netflix or anything else. I just think that, in general, Americans are absorbing just waves of content, you know, whether it is audio or video or streaming or whatever. So, you know, I don't think it's a mutually exclusive thing, but the more radio-only people are out there, the for all of us, right?
And it's funny because I have a Jacobs Media 2016 survey in front of me for why people listen to radio, and you should and I just want to point out, yeah, there are things that can translate across media, but there are things that radio really can do specifically that are important. And in this Jacobs Media 2016 survey, about 50% said they were in the habit of listening. Most wanted to listen to specific DJs or hosts, but 39% answered that they turned on the radio to get in a better mood,
yep,
or to change their mood. And I don't really see going on the internet. I don't see Facebook. Facebook is having a huge problem right now with the moods that people who are consuming it use. That's why they curate your timeline and do all that. Radio really does have sort of a specific interaction with people that's very unique.
It really does. I mean, and I'm really glad you brought that up, Mike. It fills an emotional need. It is a companion. It can uplift your spirits. It can keep you company. It can put you in a better mood. And you're not getting that from a lot of other mediums. And so, you know, that is what is inherently unique to our industry. By the way, just for the fun of it, in this past year, in that list of questions that we asked, we added a new option for people. It's free. That turned out to be number two. But you know what?
When free is good.
Yeah, when you have to pay for SiriusXM or you have to pay for Spotify, here is something that is free, easy to access. I did a panel with Tim Westergren from Pandora a couple of years ago, and I asked him what he thinks of radio, and he was jealous of it. He called it a one-touch solution. You didn't have to download anything. You push a button and you listen. And that is never going to go away.
Tom on Facebook writes, my kids grew up listening to Focus on the Family's radio drama called Adventures in Odyssey. Now their children, our grandchildren, do the same. We listen to WFST-AM in Caribou and on the net at www.familyradiowfst.com. We have just a little bit of time left, but I want to ask each of you, Mike and Paul, if we're having this conversation in 10 years... 20 years, are people still listening to radio on the dial in their cars?
I think they are.
Oh, I think they definitely are. Now, they might be also in their cars reading a book.
That's another show.
yeah. I mean, because the car will be driving itself and we're all just going to be passengers. Radio's not going to go away. Somebody, you know, has famously called it, and this is an endearing term, a cockroach medium. You can't kill us. We have survived movies and television and streaming and everything else, and I just don't see a scenario where it goes away.
I like that, Paul. I am involved in cockroach media. So anyway, as are both of you. Thank you so much for being here on the program. That was Paul Jacobs, Vice President and General Manager of Jacobs Media Strategies, and Michael Socolow, Associate Professor at the University of Maine. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, reaction to the governor's final State of the State address. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.